CliffCentral.com.
Yes, that was Kendrick Lamar with Tints. Yes, it has no reference to any anatomy. It's just that he likes tints on his windows. That wasn't hard to pick up, was it? It wasn't too cryptic, eh, Michael?
Well, I actually learned this week that the highest window tinting you can get is 35%.
Is that like by manufacturer, or is that what legally
that's
is allowed?
Legally in South Africa.
35%. That's quite a high tint.
I thought it was a low tint. I wanted like proper. You could not see. You know, like when the you have black rims, then you have black metallic body paint, and then these windows that are just blacked out.
Okay, but those.
Why exactly do you want that?
No, it's like the gangster theme. It's so cool.
Kendrick Lamar just said he wants tints, so Michael Flax wants tints as well. Best believe that Jimmy's getting tints. But and those god awful blue light brigades, what's their tint?
Oh, theirs must be their own like 50%.
Fuckers. Oh, I hate that.
I've learned a lot this week. Insurance, window tinting.
I hate those people so much.
Are you going to give your car a name?
So someone actually asked me that the other day. What are you going to name it? And I was like, I think it's just got to come to me naturally. I'm not going to give it a name that it has to live up to. I'd rather it live up to a name that it picks for itself, if that even makes sense.
No, that's exactly how you do it, Michael. You're spot on. You're so right. So in the first hour today, we're speaking about remote offices and doing things online and how people want to be face-to-face. Some people don't want to be face-to-face, and the various ways that like offices are now sort of like being disrupted, because everything gets disrupted nowadays. Disruption culture is something you can do in marketing and be made sound very, very smart. So someone says here, I'm going for an interview, which is going to be via VC.
Nice.
VC?
Video conference.
There we go. I mean, could you not have just written video conference?
Those are very hard interviews.
How much time did you save? And what did you do with the time just to say VC? I'd much rather go to an interview where I can shake everyone's hand and have a real chat. Any tips for a VC interview? Yeah, I totally get you. I'd also, for something like an interview, you want to be able to like see someone. Because if you're going to work with someone, I don't know, like video conference just seems so impersonal on an interview level. I can get if it's an international company and there's just geography in play. But if you're in the same city.
But even with international companies, because communication is lots of stuff. It's verbal and nonverbal.
Exactly.
You would know this, right? So you also, just that body language of knowing how people interact with other people is very important.
So we need to give this person some advice for their video chat interview, because it's a lot harder than a face-to-face.
It is. You're going to get scrutinized in a way that only you can do so much about. So obviously, I don't know. I'm not sure if this is a guy or a girl.
Firstly, your internet connection. Make sure that's good and that you got no load shedding or anything coming up today.
So whatever you were downloading, stop downloading it. Keep it as a single screen. Get all your bandwidth towards beaming your face to these people. Good point, Flex.
Phone a friend first and just test your microphone and your video quality.
Another good point, Flex.
Also, don't have too much in the background. It could be distracting for the person interviewing you. Try have like a plain background and remember to smile and like have a lot of energy. That's how you're going to carry your personality across here.
But also, to Flex's third good point there.
Good
three.
Light.
You need two more. You know, impress Googie for life.
Okay. So you need to remember that at the end of the interview, you need to ask what the next steps are. Don't just leave it as like the ball in
Michael,
their court.
Are you like a recruitment manager? These are gold.
And number one thing to do during this interview, do not ever give them a number. So if they ask how much you want for the job, do not give them a number. You reply to them, what value does the company place on the position? What is the budget for the position? Do not give them a number. And if they ask for your payslips, do not hand those over.
Who are you?
Michael, I've read a lot.
Michael, that was brilliant. But now you said you resigned from your job last week.
Yeah.
Is that because you're just so confident you want to take some more interviews because you know what you're doing?
No, I just wanted to take like the next step in my career. I felt like just entered the 27 club. It was time to step up positions, start at a new nice company, etc.
For me, I'm so ashamed that both of us didn't make the most of our 27 clubs back when we had them. I don't think we did what Michael was doing. Lots and lots of messages again. It's so great to see that coming back to the show after all these months that you guys still care so much. So much. I do not wear pants if I'm doing a voiced video conference interview. That's from Rob. Rob, fair point. You know, pants, this is the thing. The same way that people should be surprised by time, Ben, I get so irritated when people are surprised by people's intelligence and demeanor, or lack thereof, I guess, also to add to that, yeah? Wow, this video conferencing is quite a subject. I once interviewed a guy via video conference. It's VC, right?
Yeah.
Nails. He came across so well, also had a physical presence, seemed like a big guy. When he arrived in person, he was short, squat, and a total psycho. Went through 6 months of hell before we can get rid of him.
You got catfish,
you see,
eh?
If you had a real conversation and the full 360, right? You would have known he's a psycho up front. Although some people are really good at interviews. Some people are really good at interviews. And then they get the job and then they are a dud.
But also do like a background search on the dude. Go to like his Facebook profile. Go to his friends. See who's hanging out with. See what he posts.
You've got to consult for companies. This new you, this 27-year-old you, just got so much about you.
In fact, this could be the thing that you do remotely, Michael.
You know how much cash dollar is in HR?
You could do this for people. You know, consult with people who are getting ready for interviews. They could pay you.
There's a market.
Michael, yes, especially in these times where people are scrutinizing interviews so much more. They're trying to get the most out of their screening process. A mate of mine's in recruitment. He says it's a very difficult business. It's very cutthroat. It's very competitive. But within these niches that online presence is giving us, you've got a future here.
So the question is, would you go to someone for consultation on how to better your job interview skills, etc.? What's the WhatsApp number here?
Sure. If it was about getting a job that you want, the WhatsApp number here is 079-748-2090.
This is Flax doing a dipstick.
What's a dipstick?
Testing your idea. You're testing your idea.
And if market research.
Flax was a very kind of different dipstick last time I saw him. This is amazing. Okay, Pumi, people are going to take you on about your day zero claims about Uncle Tony. Carl says, Pumi is being a little full of it. Day zero was semi-manufactured, but it absolutely worked. They had to make an event of it. It was a serious situation, and that ploy worked. Where's the manufactured outrage now? Now, in the first hour, Pumi released a bombshell that basically Tony Leon was one of the instigators of Day Zero, which was a manufactured thing around the water shortages. Now, one thing we cannot deny that it didn't rain in Cape Town. It was bone dry for quite a while. The dams weren't great. Anybody who had a drone would then make a video going, oh, Cape Town's going to die. It's at the end. The end is nigh. So, obviously, there's always two sides to a story, and then there's the media that runs with certain things. All right. I should get into this maybe Thursday. I watched an interesting show last night called Why Do People Hate?
Why Do People Hate?
That. It's on DSTV Catch-Up. Maybe try watch it and then we'll talk about it on Thursday.
I think it's also, like, I don't know if it's like
Show like Max. Is it like a series or documentary?
Yeah, it's a series. I think Steven Spielberg's one of the producers.
Oh, mad.
But it's interesting because, you know, it's just so obvious. You know, if you look at, because we've got elections coming up in America, where we're going to see what hate really is. So, Pumi, if you wouldn't mind just elaborating a bit more about Tony Leon, where he's been, what he's been doing. Because, I mean,
he's been and what he's been doing. Well, have you not seen what is happening with him and Mashaba and Tony Leon? I think you must leave this to Canton on Thursday.
Okay.
Dude, the Tony Leon, the DA,
is okay, so
Herman Mashaba, Musi Maimane, that thing is just the house of cards. I don't know if it's going up in flames or tumbling down.
Yeah, you're right. This probably is a Thursday thing. Because I mean, like, I loathe politicians and I loathe the fact that they are given so much prominence in this world because I don't think anything really comes of them other than negativity and really bad things, like the worst of society and culture. So I try to stay away from that. But then I did see a newspaper headline the other day because newspapers are sometimes in places where I go. And Tony Leon came back. I was like, what would Uncle Tony be part of?
Yeah, he was part of a delegation to go and nicely speak to Musi Maimane about maybe stepping down.
Yeah, but Musi Maimane's also been pretty. I mean, that guy. I've got more confidence in a petrified poodle than Musi Maimane to do anything. It doesn't strike me as someone who's got a lot of conviction. Anyway, that's okay. Let's go Thursday. So if you got messages about Pumi's Day Zero thing,
there's a Daily Maverick article about
which
it,
which you referenced again. So,
but there's also in fact, at the time there was quite a lot of. Of talk about it when it did come out. And this is because, remember, it also kept being pushed out. Like,
yes.
Day Zero was like in 30 days. And then it was like, actually, it's going to be in 6 months. Hey,
so
y'all are doing well.
So it was like,
now going to be in 2019.
If you save now, this is what you get. Yeah, like, For me, I totally get it. I haven't read the Daily Maverick article, so I can't speak any further on it. But I think Carl does allude to a good point that
it works.
Something drastic needs to be pulled in for people to stop wasting water.
Why don't... So, you know, like Elon Musk decided he's going to build a tunnel and like... you could transport a lot quicker underground.
Yeah, especially LA. Yeah.
Why doesn't some rich billionaire decide to build a water tunnel to people that have water and bring the water here? Sure, it might take some time, but it's going to be beneficial in the future.
Michael? Well, there are a couple of things. There's also like the glaciers from the North Pole kind of being melted down. We had this conversation. There was in one of the podcasts a couple of weeks back, also one of the Thursday conversations. So, I mean, there are lots of things happening. I think everybody is quite aware of the water crisis, and South Africa is particularly vulnerable because we are a dry country, you know, so we are particularly vulnerable.
We're not getting much rain, and that's just... I've been living in Johannesburg for, I don't know, about 16, 17 years. I remember when I moved here, December, November, October. I'm going about this in a very bad sort of chronological order. But
yeah,
January,
I was trying to
February,
work out what you missed over here.
Summer
was raining. Like, it would rain for like days and days and like days and days.
And kind of afternoon thunderstorms.
Yeah, but it was like you set your clock to it almost. I know that sounds like something Gareth would say from his generation, but I moved up from Cape Town where the rain fell in the winter. So it was very strange to have summer rainfall, but boy, did it always rain. And now we are like mid-October, which I completely comprehend because we've had September. And it's so dry. You can scratch on the word dry, like that advert back in the 90s.
What are they saying? Why it's not raining?
There was an article in The Economist a couple of weeks ago also about kind of worldwide how deserts are becoming bigger and bigger simply because the world is becoming... It's global warming, yo.
Scary, yo.
Well, look, it's also just resources, people migrating to certain places. Like I had that issue with one of Google's stories earlier about the huge demand on the medical sector. Less doctors, more people. Less, same amount of water, more people. You know, all these things add up. It's not exactly rocket science. There's been some requests for us to upload yesterday's podcast from 8 o'clock. So in the pre-recorded stuff that we do actually play here, you know, that's... The Tim Noakes interview from yesterday.
Yeah,
It's an old interview.
I remember Tim Noakes coming here.
Yeah.
Does someone want that interview?
Yes.
So they can find that on Iona, which is where some people get their podcasts. It'll be under Gareth's guests. Yeah.
We actually over the years, so I have some of these memories because I have been here since day zero of Cliff Central. We have a couple. So on the Iono, we do actually have a couple of people who did speak to Dr. Tim Noakes, including Cindy Van Sale, who was one of our early doctors on the Cliff Central.
Cindy was a hooter.
Oh, I used to love her. Oh, my God.
Wow.
I could come here with any aches and pains and she'd treat it.
Because she did the diet and she's a big fan of it and she lost quite a lot on it. So she also did an interview with Tim Noakes and Gareth did an interview with Tim Noakes. So lots of angles that you can go. But check out the podcast.
Yeah,
if you just go forever. If you just go onto cliffcentral.com, you go onto GCS. Hashtag GCS in the menu. You click on Gareth's guests. This is very good. It's like I'm like Michael here. I'm giving advice.
Right.
And then you go into the search function, type in the name of whoever you want to see, and there will go. Hey presto, on cliffcentral.com. There it is. Tim Noakes and Gareth standing there after a triumphant chat, which you can access at any given time. Right there and then. So, Pubby, would you mind alluding to what we're going to have in the 7:30 and 8 o'clock of the show today?
Is it simply because you will not say Pixlikasem?
No, it's just that I've been speaking a lot at the show. I need to access some messages to see what's going to be worth reading.
Sneaky.
So
then.
If you can do that.
Pumi, thanks for picking up on that.
No, I'm just making sure.
If you can do that, it gives me a minute to pad the messages so that I can really read some good ones and then not have to just blindly go into them. And I just said blindly, which cues her into the segment.
One of my favorite podcasts on the Cliff Central app is Blind History. And today's Blind History episode is about Pixlika Isaka Seme, the man who encouraged black farmers to buy land in the early 1900s, became one of the first black lawyers in South Africa, and attended Columbia and Oxford universities before being one of the founding fathers of the ANC, has almost been forgotten by history. But part of the reason Blind History is here is to open your eyes to some of the history we have forgotten. Find out about Pixley Ka Isaka Seme in this episode, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
Oh, way.
Very nice. Very nice for me. So
clean.
That will be, obviously the award-winning Blind History.
Can I tell you about this app since you raised the topic and the word blind? There's this really awesome app out there whereby you sign up and you can actually help blind people. So what it does is it sets up a video call. So these guys will be on the app that are blind and they'll need assistance. And then they will video call you and you'll help them read like words on bottles, etc. And it's really like uplifting. I don't know if I'm giving it the best explanation here, but it's really cool. So you sit in a queue and they'll have their problem and what they need help with, and then you'll go on a video call with them, and then you can actually guide them through it. Or you can, let's say they're trying to read an article or something, you can actually read it to them, etc. So it's pretty nice. I think I forgot the name of the app, but if you Google it, it should come up, and you should really sign up and just give it a try. It's pretty uplifting.
Nice, Flex.
Anyone for my consulting services there, Ben?
The reason, again, Pubi, like I thought if you read that, I can go through the messages and find them. But as I'm doing that, more messages come in.
Well, just play the episode of Blind History, buy yourself a little bit of time, and then read the messages, Ben.
Is that what we want to do?
Why don't we just read them?
Are we going to do that? We're going to make a team vote right here. Gugu, are you okay with that?
What was Pumi saying? Sorry?
Pumi saying we should go straight to Blind History.
I think we got a bit of time, Ben.
No. You obviously didn't hear it. So go straight to Blind History, yeah. And then I can then scan the messages, get the best ones,
and then
read
come
the
back.
Messages, come back, and then we've got another feature for you at 8.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think let's do that. Let's do that. Sounds good.
Okay, four votes. Let's do it.
It's a democratic show after all, and I'm just the guy at the desk. But here we go.
You just work here, us.
This week's episode of Blind History.
He died alone. Bankrupt, alcoholic, and written out of history by the very party he founded. The party that would go on to win the elections and govern democratic South Africa under the iconic Nelson Mandela.
The time to build is upon us. We have at last achieved our political emancipation.
Sadly, the name Pixley Ka Isaka Seme is unknown to so many, even within the ANC. There are no great airports named after him and no black consciousness movements that shout his name, and the conversations about land, so controversial now, give him no credit, even though he started them almost 100 years ago. History isn't fair. Sometimes it's blind. Another episode of Blind History Season 2, and an episode on somebody who is more local and not that long ago, but someone who's unfortunately been airbrushed out of history and largely forgotten. Anthony Medera is here with me. I'm Gareth Cliff. This is Blind History. Are you excited about Pixley Ka Isaka Seme?
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Are you really? Because, yeah. I mean, when I suggested it, everybody else in the office went, huh?
Yeah.
Who? And that's because he's actually been, with intent, taken out of ANC history. He was probably the most important founder of the ANC. He was one of the first black lawyers in South Africa. He was educated at Columbia and Oxford, so no slouch on the academic front. He was essential to the formation of what would eventually become African nationalist organizations in South Africa, and most people don't know his name. I first heard his name when Justice Malala told me about the work that he'd done to research him. He was a difficult guy to find information about, right?
Yeah, I agree 100%. It was also a bit difficult for me, but there is. I mean, first of all, he had a remarkable education. If you looked at how and the life of a South African, especially a black South African, at that time. And I think it was very much thanks to Reverend Pixley.
Right.
And it doesn't state anywhere that he's taken the name, but I mean, I would assume it must have been, yeah.
So, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So he was a missionary. So he must have said or shown something to the Reverend Pixley, the missionary, for him to send him to Mount Hermon School in Massachusetts in the USA, and that really kicked him off.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible thing. If you think about a lot of black history in South Africa, most people just see it as really only starting in terms of biased and stereotypical system at the time. You don't think 1900. You start thinking maybe 1950s, you know, when you know, the apartheid government came in and there was resistance to that. But there were active and powerful black people with agency around at the turn of the century that were already doing things. And Pixley was very much one of those. His father was a guy called Sinono Kuana Seme. He was born in Dachaskral in Mpumalanga, modern-day Mpumalanga. It was then considered, I think, part of KwaZulu-Natal. His mother was actually the sister of the first president of the ANC, John Langalibalele Dube. In fact, we'll get to how that happened later on, but he was a descendant of chiefs as well. So they didn't come from a family of nothing. Mm. But he did go overseas, as you said, and studied at Columbia, which is a very reputable university. He studied law, and he was actually awarded the Curtis Medal, which is the highest oratorical honor that you can bestow on someone at Columbia, for a speech that he made in 1906 called The Regeneration of Africa. I actually found an excerpt from that. He said, "I am an African, and I set my pride in my race over against a hostile public opinion." I mean, you imagine, this is 1906. Mm. "Men have tried to compare races on the basis of some equality. In all the works of nature, equality, if by it we mean identity, is an impossible dream." That's how he started the speech, and it was considered to have been groundbreaking at the time. He went on from Columbia to study at Oxford University, where he finished in law and was actually admitted to the Middle Temple as a barrister in 1910.
That's an incredible education.
There couldn't have been that many black barristers in 1910.
Definitely not. He was 29 by then, so he'd spent a lot of time in Western society. So, you know, if there's anybody that's going to come back with the beliefs that he had and make a real difference back in South Africa, it would have been him.
Yeah. Well, he did. He came back almost straight away after qualifying and being admitted as an advocate. And he came back to South Africa and came to practice law in Johannesburg, where he had a reasonably successful career. He mostly was known for handling land issues for small black farmers, and he encouraged black farmers in 1911 to buy their own land. Mm. Now, this, again, might strike people who see our history as being very unidimensional as a strange thing, but black people could own land up to the Native Land Act of 1913, which only was brought about because Pixley encouraged black farmers to buy their own property.
Yeah.
So if he hadn't encouraged black people to buy their own property, maybe the government would never have brought the Native Land Act into question. But at the same time, how many black people knew they could buy property in those days?
So he guarded that a lot. And then he also got involved with purchasing land, and that actually hurt him financially.
Yeah.
A couple of moves that really
hurt him. Didn't come off of it reputationally very well either, because he's regarded as having really extorted money out of vulnerable and poor black farmers for a long time. So the record isn't exactly favorable to him in that respect.
But it was a tough time. I mean, if you look at 1910, all over the world, it was a very, very difficult time. And, you know, that's why it's, sometimes he was harshly treated in that when he founded the South African Native National Congress.
Right, the prologue to the ANC.
He, you know, that first decade was the worst performance that that had.
That's right.
But, I mean, every single person on this planet was struggling then. So well, you've got to be fair.
I just want to refer quickly to that South African Native National Congress, which was the prologue, really, as we said, to the ANC. In January 1912, they established that. And he took responsibility for most of the form and structure of how the organization would be built. And he proposed his uncle, John Dube, for president, who then he became the first president of the ANC. But he was doing a lot of other things at the same time. He was lawyer to the Swazi Queen, and her name was Labotsibeni, and later he also accompanied King Sobhuza II to London. And that was when they had Swaziland proclaimed as a country.
Mm.
So again, this man had a very direct hand in having both Swaziland and Lesotho proclaimed as sovereign countries, which is no small feat.
It's definitely
not. When we talk about how so many black people were disenfranchised and didn't have their own ability to make kind of important decisions over their own destiny because of racism and colonialism and apartheid. There was this guy going, I don't care, I'm going to do this anyway. And largely it was successful in terms of the proclamations of sovereignty there. But he did organize Africans, according to most historians, in a similar way to the way that Mahatma Gandhi organized Indians who were being largely marginalized. He married two women, both of them the daughters of kings. He married Phikisele Dinizulu, who was the daughter of the Zulu king, and Lozinja, who was the daughter of the Swazi king. So he clearly made alliances for political purposes, but also had a direct relationship with those monarchs because they were also the main funders of the early SANNC.
All the funding was basically from the chiefs.
Mm.
And so that's what was very difficult at the time, because actually the support wasn't there from the chiefs.
That's right. But when it was there, it wasn't always consistent.
Yeah, exactly. But he was very strategic. Once again, we stem back to his time that he spent overseas for the first 20 years of his teenage onward life. And that made a massive difference. His life went a little bit off the boil.
Yeah.
I think he wasn't an aggressive individual.
He reminds me a little bit of Thabo Mbeki. And it's interesting, we'll get to how he and Thabo Mbeki are linked later on, because there was something quite obviously
wrong with it, 100%. Thabo's
side. You know, he was this cold academic. Mm. He wasn't really a man of the people. He was much more a thoughtful, sensible, theoretical kind of guy. Mm. And although he had great ideas and unquestionably a brilliant mind, I don't think he had the heart and the courage to accompany it. But
I agree. At oratory, I mean, he was he was a phenomenal orator.
Way with words.
Exactly. And there were times it was almost frustrating. Look, obviously, I wasn't there, but that in critical times where he could have really fought some of the acts that came out during that time, he didn't. That was where they needed him.
I think you're referring to like 1927, where the ANC had their elective conference, and he was present, but he hardly took part at all, because he'd gone through a bit of a tough time, which we'll get to in a second. But he could have spoken up more, and the ANC's Congress didn't go so well because the socialists and the communists kind of came to the fore. Mm. And he was very much against the socialists and communists. And because he didn't speak up and he was nominally the leader of the more nationalist part of it as opposed to the socialist part of it, they went in a direction where they allied themselves much more closely with the Communist Party of South Africa. And that forced him out of hibernation because he realized he'd made a mistake. Because he was opposed to the communists, he was eventually elected president general in 1930. But as you said, it was a terrible time for the ANC, the SANNC, which would become the ANC, mostly because everyone in the world was suffering. The Great Depression had come along. He had had some pretty tough times. He had had a drunk driving accident because just after he'd lost a case for the Swazi regent, after he returned from London,
he was really devastated.
And he then took to the bottle quite heavily.
But the interesting thing was, is when you say, what were they pulling carts?
He was driving a car.
Automobile.
He was driving a car and he caused an accident. I think someone was killed.
And he was disbarred.
He was disbarred. He was struck off the roll, which meant that he couldn't practice law anymore.
Mm.
And it took its toll on him to the point where he just kind of disappears for a few years. And then eventually in 1930 comes back as president of that SANNC. And they were going through a very difficult time. Mm-hmm. He had a friend. You know, a lot of these streets and these names, what I love about researching this stuff for Blind History is I suddenly discover why a certain street is named after a certain person. And I didn't know who Sefako Mahatu was until I read the story of
he was the president
of the Transvaal department of the SANNC.
And
I think he was the guy who managed to figure out that if you allied yourself quite closely with the unions and you went into strike mode, that could cripple the mining industry.
They really did. I mean, that was very, very successful in terms of what they're trying to achieve.
Well, we're still dealing with that today.
Yeah.
It's not like it's gone away.
Yeah.
But Pixley was a bit of an authoritarian. He didn't like to listen to other people. He was a centrist as well, like Thabo Mbeki. There were allegations of financial mismanagement. He was upstaged by the unions.
Yeah, they actually were more. They were making a bigger impact than he was.
That's right. Yeah, and he had sort of very sagging and unfortunate fortunes towards the end of that. So eventually they threw him out. It was quite a big deal. Mahatu was removed as well, and he left politics in 1937. Mm. He gave up on the idea of being a politician and a leader, And really, from then on, he just practiced law in Johannesburg.
Yeah. And opened a newspaper, actually.
Important to note.
But I think correct. At least he was talking to them now. That was very, very important.
Yeah, that Abantu Batu newspaper was actually originally published in all the African languages and English. And the purpose of it was to bring all the tribal differences and the various ethnic backgrounds in Guni and Sotho and Tswana all together so that, that black people could stand up for themselves as a political entity. So it was quite a big goal.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't been there to make that happen, it might never have happened.
Very ambitious.
Huge.
The thing, though, is if he had been consistent during those 30 years, you know, who would know what it would look like today?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was a slippery slope. We went downhill from there.
Well, even the ANC did. I mean, they had their worst period then. There were also allegations and accusations that the Nguni people in the ANC were like a hegemony. They controlled everything.
Mm.
They had the lowest urban and rural membership numbers in their history in the ANC. And it really was not a great time for them. In the Transvaal especially, there were lots of people who felt that they were a one-dimensional organization. And he did, in that time, manage to mentor Anton Lembede, which was quite a big deal, because Anton Lembede went on to become the first ANC Youth League president and contributed enormously to the ideology of the ANC and the fact that, you know, young black people, you have agency, you have the ability to determine your own future, you have the ability to educate yourself. It was really in his footsteps that Nelson Mandela largely followed.
But what he brought with him was the structure and how he organized it right in the very, very beginning in 1910. He organized the South African Native National Congress, and later on that structure went forward into the future.
For better or for worse, the guy did a pretty amazing job for his time. But it does warrant a mention here of, again, Thabo Mbeki, because I can't keep but draw parallels between the two. In 2006, Thabo Mbeki posthumously awarded him the Order of Luthuli in gold. And he did that for the speech that I read an extract from earlier in 1906 at Columbia. Again, I think there was a deep vein of inspiration that I think Thabo Mbeki drew from the life of Pixley Kaisa Kaseme. And the ANC has since, really, since he died in the 1950s, tried to airbrush him out of history.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why a lot of us never heard of Pixley.
Well, you know what Stalin tried to do with Trotsky and Lenin and all the rest of them. He tried to take them out of – he did. He actually had them photoshopped, in an early sense, out of pictures.
Mm.
This is a very Marxist way of dealing with things. And because the Marxists were eventually victorious in the ANC, he was considered to have been from the losing side.
Yeah, so a nationalist.
So they Trotskyed him out of ANC history.
Yeah.
But without this guy, he was absolutely, undeniably, according to scholars, the public – and people who are discovering more and more information as we go forward, that this guy, had he not come along, there would not have been an ANC.
Yeah.
So they owe more to him than they do to Dube in many ways.
And the thing, though, Gareth, is that a lot of the writings, there's not a lot of information. You know, in the newspaper, they don't talk about necessarily what he's talking about, the Land Act. But there's a lot of things that we need to learn of what he was doing in all those years where they said he went back to law. Because if you've got that burning inside you, got to come out somewhere.
He went into law, came back into politics, and did this a few times. Mm. And clearly the guy felt there was a need for public service. And for all the things that we find, you know, not fitting in terms of leadership in him now, I think there must have been some real characteristics of strength and of power and almost a hypnotic effect on people. He did, however, it has to be said, die bankrupt. He was largely forgotten by the ANC when he died. There is a great book by Bongani Nkululunga. It's called The Man Who Founded the ANC. And in that book, there are also some interesting revelations. I saw that Professor Kumalo has written an article about this, where there are allegations that he lied about having a master's degree and a doctor's degree. Mm. And, you know, in the light of all the important stuff he did, that's not really a big deal to me. It's not, you know, it's kind of like when someone lies on their CV these days, because he had certainly developed his bona fides by then. Mm. And he did swindle some money from poor people for legal advice, which doesn't speak well of his character. But there was this quote from Prof. Kumalo: "The vision of a self-reliant and developed continent is embedded in the figure of Pixley Kaisa Kaseme." He articulated this in his 1906 speech. And I think that's a very good point. He's a guy who's maligned and misrepresented historically. And if our episode of Blind History can somehow put that right, then his memory can be reignited. And I think people can be very proud that he was a South African who managed to change the face of politics and invent organizations that have become much more powerful than he ever was. Thanks for listening to the award-winning Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
All right, we're learning something.
Credit to the Khayelitsha United Mambazo Choir for the introductions in Nkosi Sikelele Africa.
Thank you, Gareth. We are learning something every single day here on Cliff Central, as per usual. Blind History is a wonderful weekly podcast. If you have missed previous ones, well, of course, you need to go to cliffcentral.com. Just like you can find the Tim Noakes interview from earlier, just like you can find all kinds of other amazing shows, it's all there. So we don't get too much into this, but Pumi addressed the whole Day Zero thing, that there was more to play than what we maybe thought, and there was more nefarious kind of dealings with it. Very good point out of all the messages that I've kind of gone through here is that the problem with Day Zero is the amount of money people spent on self-sustainable water systems, people who didn't have that money in the first place. That's a bit of a different take, because we're all made to believe that we all have to have those big JoJo tanks and we all have to go off the grid. Look, I think also what it comes down to, we've had this conversation many times in the show, the more you can be self-sufficient, the better, I think, going forward in this country, and maybe just in life in general. But it is a good point. I think a lot of people made a lot of money out of it, but with everything in life, there's winners and losers. So in situations, you can take advantage of it, and that'll always be a fact of life. That's just how it is. We also had a really great discussion earlier around being in an office, whether you have to be in an office or whether you can just be more of a virtual kind of person. Now, Richard had you find the message and then it's just gone because another 10 pop up. Where's Richard? Richard was here. Richard had a really good point about Thomas Cook and adapting and things.
Thomas Cook is Apple, no? No, that's Tim Cook.
That's Tim Cook.
Okay, find Richard's message.
Richard, I've lost it. It was right here. I specifically took a break so I could find it. Oh, it's just frustrating.
Just read anything, Ben.
What's like the first message, the top one?
Okay, so Michael Flax, who's come back more worldly than ever, he was giving out some amazing consultant tips around how to get a job, interview, and that kind of stuff. So someone says here, Michael, to echo your thoughts, how's it, guys? I recently interviewed for a company, and I agree. Do not give them your payslips. It's a trap. I gave them a number and gave them my payslips, and they did not give me what I'd originally asked for. It's absolute BS. I'm thinking of rejecting the offer that came to me.
Reject the offer.
Reject the offer.
No, don't reject the offer. Oh. Negotiate the offer. Say, listen,
that's the same thing.
No, rejection's too negative. You need to start saying, listen, thank you for the offer, but given my living expenses and that, could we be a bit more flexible on the numbers? I believe given my experience and that, I'd really excel in the position. And it would be great to be involved in the company, and let's see if we can come to an agreement with the numbers. Maybe we can push it up 10,000 rand.
Of course, if you want Michael's professional help, he does charge by the hour. Just leave your name and number to 079-748-2090.
And he will call you right back.
What Richard was saying is that the traditional way of doing business is outdated, and if you don't recognize your company change hierarchy and let your employees be creative, it'll be a slippery slope downwards. So it just echoes what we were saying about the whole Uberizing your company. It's about getting with the time and moving to innovate, or else your company is dead. Just like what happened to Thomas Cook, 200-year-old company gone because it did not want to innovate and get with the times. Now, I read another thing recently this week. One of the most damning things you can ever say about your company is anybody in managerial positions uses the words, "That's just how we do it." If you have a boss that says that, if you have a company that prides itself on something like that, maybe ask Flax to try find a new job.
Yeah, at the end of the day, people – so there's like a couple sayings. People don't leave companies. People leave their leadership team. So is that sort of like closed-minded thinking that you just mentioned from Richard, that sees companies start to crumble. Because you need to remember that you're not employing someone to tell them what to do. You're employing them because you think they know what to do better than you. Otherwise, you might as well just do the job. So they're going to come in from a different aspect, a different way of thinking. And they might actually streamline things because they see different patterns than you. So you really need to trust your employees. You can't micromanage them. Otherwise, you're not getting the value out of them.
Well, there we go. There we go.
Wise words, Vax.
And Carl,
thank you.
Carl says, Carl says, Ben, you're making Gareth look like he's a genius by able to run the show and read the messages. Carl, look, it's a fair point, but you do realize that Gareth will literally just pick any message and read it because he doesn't really care. I'm more caring with the messages because I know it takes time and effort for you people to read to send these things to us, and therefore I like to read them and I like to consider them. But yes, we can also go with what you said. So LeboM is a, how can we put this nicely, for me, celebrated musician, composer, The Lion King. These are all things you associate with LeboM. Plus, there's also the fact that he loves weddings, clearly. He is about to be married for the fifth time.
Number five.
Lucky, is it lucky number five, or does it stop at lucky number three and from there it's just insanity number four, five, six?
So, you know, the reason I told you the story is because I saw it this morning when I was about to get ready to come to the show. And I was like, this guy, really? Again? How many times?
This guy again?
How many times do you try to get something right before you actually just go, you know what, this ain't for me. This one is just one of those things that I'm okay with saying. You know, I just wasn't good at this.
Like when you try make a souffle or a creme brulee, you can try five times. I don't think weddings and marriages maybe should be tried.
But even a creme brulee, right? Even that, you must have some kind of cutoff that says, I'm going to try this thing. I'm going to see if I can do it. Maybe the first time I need to change this, I need to change that. The second time, third, fourth, what?
It's probably just a hopeless romantic for me.
Just got to,
you know, he envisions himself married with kids, picket fence, happily ever after.
Okay,
but he's got kids.
He's a bad investor. If you take a single wedding at 200,000 rand minimum, this oak has wasted $1 million already.
Michael Dragon's
if this one fails as well.
Jeez. But okay, there are so many different offshoots of this question or of this topic. But like, if you are this woman who is going to become number five, you've got questions for the rest of them, right?
Yeah. Can I speak to the other four?
Can you imagine a reality?
What went wrong?
Can you imagine a reality show of all those women coming together to hang out with number five for a weekend?
Yeah. I mean, also when you are number five, like, what do you think
you're going to
do differently?
Yeah.
That four other people have dismally failed at getting right.
Is he allowed to ask for the rings back from the other four? Yeah, or do they just keep it?
I don't know what the protocol on that is.
Maybe Michael, are you just cheap like that?
No, I'm just like
what
thinking
it's
a lot of money, boy.
What is he going to do with the ring?
Well, no, he could combine the rings and get a bigger ring.
I don't know. Like, maybe use it again. It looks like he's into doing
this. It's like
this
compounded interest with rings.
Can you imagine number five has this ring, which is just like, it's like Thanos' glove.
It's like 19 carats.
You know, but look, I mean, well, that sounds disparaging towards us. Okay, so LeboM, clearly, as Google said, hopeless romantic, which is a very endearing thing. I mean, Hugh Grant had an entire movie career based on being hopelessly romantic, or just hopeless, because he ended up with strippers in the end. But obviously, there's different.
So, like Elizabeth Taylor, right?
How many times was she married?
Eight.
Eight, sure.
Except she did marry the one guy twice.
Okay, number eight.
Oh, but it's still eight.
Eight. Like, I'm just like, really?
Will you? I do again. The same person.
What do you say when you're the priest? Welcome back.
You don't even need a priest. You're not off by heart by that stage.
You just say the thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But also, before I get to what I think will be a moral bottom line in this, is that do you have the exact same enthusiasm for the weddings? Do you have the same wedding planner? Does the wedding planner then go into retainer? Do you use the same venue or do you hope for something better? Is your budget the same or do you alter it in how much you actually love the person? This is a TV show that
for
has
your
to
menu, I'd like my first wife and my second wife's wedding combined, please.
But also, there's like different stages in life, okay? So maybe some people are suited to getting married when they're 50 for whatever reasons, who they meet, what they're doing, that kind of stuff. Some people, right out of the blocks, they want to get married in their early 20s. Like, I know if you look at, like, maybe I've met some Afrikaans people who got married very, very young. And they seem so happy with it. They're so cool with it. It's been a generational thing. That works. What if LeboM has finally hit that sweet spot? This is the time. How old is he now? 50? I think he's 52.
How long did his previous marriages last? Like, how many years?
You know, Michael, this is the odd thing. Someone has not created an infographic for
I'm
this.
I'm a numbers guy here.
No one's created an infographic for this. I don't know why.
You should do this,
we
Michael.
Could literally statistically look at how long the next one will last based off the previous ones. Mm. Because five, I think there's enough to see a pattern there.
I think we do have enough.
I think even three is enough.
Okay, so he was first married 5 years.
Okay.
Then 11.
Uh-huh. Those are big numbers.
Then five. Then three.
Okay. And their numbers are diminishing.
Next one's around about there. 4, 3 years. 4 years.
So there's definitely...
You've seen enough.
There's definitely a 3-4 year itch on average, which I maybe is fair. Wow, but that's quite
She needs to go chat to the lady that hit 11 years and see what went right there. And then speak to the woman who did the least and then see what went wrong there.
Okay, so you have to go interview Nandi Ndlovu. So clearly the first wife was 5 years. And then he's like, okay, I'm going to make this one work. And she was 11 because she's number two. 2, 3, 4. I mean, sorry, 3, 4, 5. This is just pinch hitting now. Just rolling the dice. It's like, well, hit or miss. But we do wish him all the best. Circle of life, as they say. Great Lion King pun for him. And I think with that, we are going to wrap up the show today. It's been great having the three of you in front of me. For me seeing you again after all this time. Michael, seeing you after
good to see you.
Even more this time. And you guys seem to be in very good places.
Thank you.
Which makes me happy. How's it, China? No? Someone new hasn't entered the studio. I'm talking about our next segment that Gareth has put together right here on cliffcentral.com. Is one of the best things about living in or visiting China is the endless food one gets to experience. Very good point. Asian cuisine has always been something I love. There is an endless list of incredible dishes with a tremendous range of flavors and styles. Whatever your mood, there's always something that will satisfy you. In this episode of How's It China, which you're about to hear, Gareth Cliff and Pumi visit Biru restaurant to try out the famous Chinese hot pot while they chat to Nklankla Glube, a consultant for emerging markets and Africa at Deloitte, who lived in Changgun, northeast China, for over 2 years. They talk about all delicious, weird, and amazing cuisine in different parts of China and finally uncover the truth of whether Chinese people eat dog meat.
Did you have dog meat over there for me? Don't give too much away.
So, Biru is around the corner from here.
Uh-huh.
You'll have an experience because Gareth decided that he's going to have a team meeting there one of these days.
Oh, no.
It sounds good. He spoke glowingly about it.
Dog brain.
Spectacular.
Really?
What did you order?
Spectacular. So, we had a food
experience. Oh, like a buffet.
And it's not a buffet because it's a hot pot, so they make it on the table.
Is that when they bring like the raw food to you and you cook it yourself?
Sort of, yeah. It's because on the table in front of you, there's a little gas.
Okay. I know.
It was amazing.
You know, I almost felt I should press play on the podcast. We are salivating over what you guys had at Biru. But yeah, Gareth spoke very, very warmly about it. And I can say it's because he's not here. He's not going to stop you. But Gareth hates exotic foods. He hates going to places outside of his known thing because that's just his age. But he spoke about this place as in like, I can't wait to show you this place. It's really great. It was interesting and the food was actually great. And he said his dietary tract after that was not jeopardized.
It's like...
So, I mean, that is a real...
It's got a great view. It's literally a 2-minute walk from the studio.
Ah.
It's got a great view of kind of this part of Joburg. The food is fresh. The spices are unbelievable. So, Gugu, we had this conversation about kind of summer body loading, right?
Yeah.
So this is one of the things that I was worried about because you have a food tasting experience. You're going to like...
You go overboard.
Pick out. But it didn't feel like that at all. And because of the type of ingredients that they use, it's not heavy.
Yeah.
And 2 hours later, you know, you're like...
You're feeling fine.
You're not fine.
Stuffed.
In the moment, bloated. You know, with all the chemicals and your brain kind of does feel a rush. So you do get a little bit of... You get hit by a little bit of itis in the moment. Right? But afterwards, you know, you just...
The exact address is 329 Rivonia Boulevard, Edinburgh, Sandton, and it looks like a great date idea.
Well, yeah, it's the tall building next to McDonald's, can't miss it. Huh. All right, so that's How's It China. We're going to finish the show with a message from Cindy saying, being married once was more than enough. I will never do that again. I mean, who breaks into the jail twice?
I agree.
Sorry, Cindy.
Very well put. Yeah.
I'm pulling an Oprah with my next one, right? I'm just going to find a statement type guy. It's going to be, that's it.
Just keep going.
Statement.
All right. Pubby's going to statement. We're going to go How's It China next, and then we'll chat to you again Thursday, because tomorrow we are playing pre-recorded content from the Vintok Pure Conversations. Is that right, Cuckoo?
Pure Conversations. The ladies.
The ladies version of 2.0.
All right. Have a fantastic Wednesday. Have a fantastic Tuesday. More like, yeah, we're not here on Wednesday. I'm pre-wishing, and we'll see you back on Thursday. Kenton will be here. We'll talk about more of Tony Leon. I'm definitely going to bring that up. I think it's a fascinating story. Thanks, Pumi. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Google.
Thank you. Cliffcentral.com.